This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's our weekly feature in which we answer your questions. We're responsive to your concerns. Radioprogram at AOL.com is the place to send questions. Radioprogram at AOL.com. And with me is Layla Mudin. She's our nutritionist in residence. How are you doing, Layla?
All right, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good. We've got a bunch of questions from our listeners, but I just wanted to tee off with some observations. This has been a week where I played hooky, and I was originally intended to go to a night game on Monday night, go to the Yankees, but it was rained out.
Oh, yeah.
And so they scheduled a day game. And, of course, it was a glorious day the next day after the rain cleared everything out of the air. And, being out there in the sun, great experience. I recommend it highly. It's a big community. You know, it's like thousands and thousands of people kind of communing about their sports team. And so what I noticed, though, is, and there's a nutrition element to this, is that no matter how much care I take before I go to the ballpark defer my appetite for junk food, there's something about just going to the ballpark and smelling all those aromas, you know, the grilling hamburgers and hot dogs and french fries and, you know, whatever they have there, stokes your appetite.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my thing when I go to Yankee Stadium, there's a very unusual thing at Yankee Stadium. Not sure all Yankee fans know about that, but there's a little sushi stand there. And, sometimes there's like really long lines for everything else, you know, for hot dogs and french fries and hamburgers and whatnot. But the sushi stand, perhaps because, you know, they're a little more expensive, you know, I got to say, it'll hit you up, in the blink of an eye for like $40-$50 for a couple of people for sushi.
Oh my, you might want to stick with the beer and the dog.
In terms of value, that's not a value proposition though, because the dog can be like $8.95.
Yeah.
You know, so, and the beer, of course, you know, that's like, double digit beer, in a paper cup. So what struck me, you know, as I, you know, came back to my seat with my, dutifully with my sushi, my edamame, because I had, you know, soy. You know, some people here think soy is the devil's spawn, but, you know, I think edamame is a reasonable choice at a ballpark. You know, it's pretty good. There's a couple of women sitting in front of me. Actually, you know, one of, they appeared to be sisters, and, they were, well, you know, and I don't want to stigmatize, but they were very, very heavy, very overweight. And one of them actually had difficulty sort of, you know, going down just a couple of steps and then finally wedging herself into the seat. They appeared to be in their 60s. And it was just interesting what they ordered, you know, because actually you could have stuff brought to your seat. And what they ordered was interesting. They ordered a diet Pepsi, which is virtuous, okay, right?
Yes.
But then they proceeded to order two lemonades, which are just chock full of sugar, because how do you make tart lemonade, you know, taste palatable?
Put a cup of sugar in it, right?
Yeah, right. You know, put like a half a cup of sugar in there or something. They ordered a giant dog and cheese nachos. And then I saw one of them, you know, quite overtly, She chugged down a handful of pills, medication evidently, that she took from a little medication container.
And did she down that with the lemonade?
With
or
the lemonade.
Diet Pepsi?
With the lemonade. So, I mean, I'm not sure what
not that
medical
makes a difference.
You know, and I always look. You know, I try to do like a little facial diagnosis or a little. You know, what malady does this person have? It's a something a little amusing game that I do sometimes on the subway. And you know, pretty certainly these gals had diabetes or hypertension or high cholesterol. Mm. And it was interesting their food choices. I mean, it suggests that for some people, they are sort of, they've sort of crossed the Rubicon of concern about what they eat. Although there was that nod towards Diet Pepsi, but I guess they haven't gotten the word yet that Diet Pepsi is even more associated with weight gain.
Yes.
And, you know, hence they were looking for compensatory calories in the lemonade. You know, it's like it's like one beverage that counteracts the other beverage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one thing, okay, no calories from the Diet Pepsi, but then you're looking for carbs elsewhere and you're going to. So it was, you know, nice ladies, you know, inveterate Yankee fans, you know, mm-hmm. having a pleasurable afternoon at the ball game and, you know, maybe indulging in a relaxing, little bit of hedonism there, you know, some ballpark food. You know, for all I know, they consume salads at home and lean chicken breasts, but I kind of doubt it.
Given how you say they look, sure.
Yeah.
We would doubt that, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and we tend to be a little insulated here on this program and in our practice, you know, very nutritionally oriented people. Mm-hmm. But there's just, you know, there's a lot of Americans out there for whom, you know, this message doesn't resonate. You know,
it's just. Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
And I was thinking, you know, like, what would happen if we could persuade each of those gals to go on a really clean, low-carb diet? You know, put them in with you urge compliance. But, you know, I sent you something interesting this week, and I think you actually picked up on it, which was an article about dieting.
Yeah.
And how dieting.
And the compensatory behavior of eating.
Yeah.
When you fall off the diet.
And it's sort of a paleo story because it kind of suggests that we're wired for mm-hmm. famine. But then when the famine abates, there's a mechanistic thing that's pretty irresistible that gets us to eat more when we're off our diet, right? Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that for a couple of minutes?
Well, yeah. Well, the other thing that I took from this article that you sent me, Dr. Hoffman, is that low-calorie dieting, what that means to us is chronic hunger.
Yeah.
It's chronic hunger. How long do you want to go hungry? And eventually, and this is why low-calorie diets don't work, people fall off. They're going to go eat. And the reason...
That's the Biggest Loser example, you know,
exactly.
that whole phenomenon with that TV show and how angry and upset many of the contestants are for the imposed austerity of that, the unrealistic degree of weight loss, and then the bounce back, mm-hmm. and their metabolisms are now slow to a crawl.
And that's the problem with low-calorie dieting, is Mother Nature is going to downshift the metabolism so that you survive at that level. So the moment you go off the diet and eat kind of the way you used to, or even maybe a couple of hundred more calories, the weight comes back on and then some. It's almost kind of a scarcity mindset, too, I got from that study, because, you know, think of depression era people and how don't throw things away. They take care of their things, even hoard a little.
Clean your plate, that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Right. Or only, you know, if you're having a baked potato, you're only cooking one, not making more, because that would be a waste.
Yeah, and actually a high prevalence of diabetes among concentration camp survivors, partially because of that, partially because in order to survive a concentration camp, you have to have really the ability to store fat, which is an evolutionary adaptation, fine for starvation. But once you get back to plenty, you put on extra pounds in a camel-like fashion. You know, you're storing extra fat against the exigency of a potential famine because your body kind of goes, hey, that could happen again.
that could happen again.
Yeah.
Not to mention the psychological implications.
Yeah, you know, psychological as well.
Feeling hungry for a survivor could be like a PTSD.
Yeah, you know, I spoke to one concentration camp survivor who was irrationally, you know, anybody who smokes after the age of 35 or 40, it's like committing suicide. You know, why would you even do it? But this person was in their 60s and they continued smoking. And I said, you know, why do you keep smoking? This is many years ago because now these survivors are in their 80s or 90s or they're long since passed away. But they said, the cigarette represents to me the only thing that I had of sustenance, the only pleasurable thing that I could do in the concentration camp. We would take some discarded cigarette butt of one of the one of the guards, and we would take the little bit of extract a little bit of tobacco and roll our own in some discarded paper and smoke that, and that's the only source of gratification that we had. And so realistically,
so
I can't stop.
That association is very, very soothing.
Yeah.
Understandably, why somebody like that would smoke then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, my. We have to be compassionate, too.
Yeah. But, right. And, you know, and as for those ladies, I'm not judging. You know, it's like, judgy. You know, you're very judgy about that. It's like, no, it's like, I think that their metabolism has been so commandeered. You know, as I watch these nice ladies, I said, they're not in control. They're past the point of the ability to control, and their physiology is prompting choices that are dictated by their out of control physiology at this point.
Yeah. And not to mention, and here's the thing, that the variable that we don't know, that handful of medications
Could be driving blood sugar down or so. Or
yeah, right. Yeah, could be doing that. Yeah. It could be causing a metabolic slowdown or metabolic resistance to weight
maybe
loss.
Maybe there are antidepressants. I mean, who knows? Maybe that too can cause. We have a lot of trouble with our patients who take antidepressants because of the increased cravings.
Yes. And it's interesting where you look at the face of people on the subway and say, what malady are they suffering from? Me in the grocery store.
You look at the shopping carts.
I look at the shopping carts, like the people online, and I notice some of them who are, you could tell the boxes of cereal, the packages of cookies, the plastic bags full of bread or rolls and things like that. It's like, wow, there isn't anything here from the produce aisle or the meat aisle or the fishmonger or anything like that. It's interesting. It's like,
soda and snacks. Soda and snacks.
Yeah. Again, not trying to sound judgmental or anything, but it's just interesting how that always seems to work out.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, we could just have a conversation here. But there are these nasty, intrusive things that interrupt us called questions from our listeners. So let's we love questions and we really enjoy fielding them. So let's tackle some of them now.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've got an email from Cheryl. Hi guys, listen to you all the time. Thanks so much for your valued health information. I had a heart attack 2 years ago and I was 99% blocked.
Mm.
Was under a lot of stress at the time. And I also had a lipoprotein little a of 197.
Hmm. That's very high. The proposed cutoff for lipoprotein A, it's sometimes abbreviated LP with a parentheses around a little a, lowercase a, is 50. And in some cases, 30.
Yeah.
But we'll continue the question because I want to speak to the issue of LP little a.
Yeah, Cheryl asks, on your program the other day, you mentioned that taking aspirin lowers LP little a about 50%. Did I hear this right?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Because she takes a baby aspirin every day, and she also takes Brilinta, which is an anti-platelet.
Right. Because it's the kind of thing that she's probably had. Did you have a bypass or stents, or what did she have?
She had a heart attack. She doesn't say anything
Most people who have heart attacks these days have some form of revascularization, either stents or a bypass surgery.
Yeah.
And so afterwards, in the aftermath of that, you need to take blood thinners, usually aspirin plus something like Plavix or Brilinta or something along those lines.
She's taking both of those, and she's wondering, can she also take MK7?
Yes, she can, because if she were taking Coumadin, she couldn't really take MK7. Which is a vitamin K and is an antagonist to Coumadin, but she can take it with Brilinta. So let me explain this situation with LP little a.
Yeah.
LP little a is a little acknowledged risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. And it's seldom measured because insurance doesn't often reimburse it because it hasn't been mainstreamed as a risk factor. But we check for it.
Yes.
And it's a genetic risk factor. You can also determine if you have a susceptibility to high Lp(a) through a saliva test mm-hmm. that measures your DNA. There's DNA pathways that raise Lp(a). So I have in front of me a study entitled, Are High Lp(a) Levels and Myocardial Infarction Linked? And the answer is yes, but yeah. There's some refinements to it because there are different Lp(a)s. There are subtypes of Lp(a). Wow. So depending on the lab, you may get different results. But here's an interesting thing. According to this, the influence that it has on your cardiovascular risk depends on your ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And so in 5 out of 7 ethnicities tested in a recent study, it made a difference. But in 2 out of 7, it didn't make much difference. Those are Africans. Mm. So, you know, that might mean to some extent African Americans, although African Americans often are sort of a melange of Native American, Caucasian, African, yes. and sometimes Asian. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pure Africans doesn't make a big difference. Arabs doesn't make a big difference. Chinese, we start seeing a difference. Europeans, we start seeing an elevated Lp(a) that's greater than 50, about a 50% on average increase in cardiovascular risk. In Latin Americans, it's even higher, 84%. In South Asians and Southeast Asians, that would be Indians and Pakistanis, much higher risk. In Southeast Asians, that would be like Thais, Vietnamese, you know, those people. We're going to see a higher risk. Mm-hmm. So
wow,
there you have
that's,
it.
That's interesting.
And so aspirin does is it lowers the risk associated with heart attack that Lp(a) engenders. Mm. But in other words, and I actually had a discussion with a doctor on the phone the other day. This person came in and didn't have such a high cholesterol and had a little bit of plaque. And I said, let me talk to your doctor because I don't know why, you know, it's just like, I think you remember that patient. It's a much older patient who's in the 80s. You know, why is this person on a statin? Because there's not a lot of demonstration that people on statins will benefit yes. past a certain age, especially women. So I spoke to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, she has a very high Lp(a). Mm. And so I backed off. I said, oh, okay. Since she has, you know, that's sort of a nuanced approach to it. It wasn't just, oh, you know, she's an older lady and she has a little high cholesterol. And, you know, it's like everybody should be on a statin. No, it's like he said, this person has a very high Lp(a). There are studies that suggest that people with a high Lp(a) might benefit more from cholesterol lowering than people who have a normal or low Lp(a).
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because there was a recent study that said that Lp(a) is probably a better indicator of heart attack risk than even LDL.
But there's no really way to lower it. Except, you know, and I disagree with the article here in MedPage. Actually, hormone replacement therapy seems to lower it somewhat.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So testosterone in men and estrogen, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy in women seems to lower it a little bit. But there's not some magic vitamin supplement for lowering Lp(a).
Yeah, I mean, we try with vitamin C, we try with L-carnitine, but it doesn't really completely do the job.
Yeah, there was a guy named Matthias Rath who made a lot of Lp(a) and thought you could lower risk with proline and vitamin C. Remember that? But it turns out Matthias Rath was a little bit of a, shall we say, over the top in some of his claims. He persuaded an African government to stop using conventional medications in their HIV positive population and use instead some vitamin supplement that he manufactured. So, man, the world medical establishment really came down on him for that. So he's been kind of ostracized from the mainstream discussions about nutrition and supplements.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. Okay. Rightfully so.
Yeah.
All right. So, Cheryl, no, aspirin does not lower Lp(a), but
keep taking it.
Can help. Yeah. Keep taking it, absolutely.
Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com.
We've got an email from June. Thanks very much for your article on ways to relieve GERD. I am interested in Endofen, but I
That's
can't...
That's at drhoffman.com, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I am interested in Endofen, but cannot have caffeine near bedtime. You recommend taking Endofen in the evening, but the green tea is concerning. If I only take the Endofen in the morning, will it still be effective? Yes.
So, but also, I think there's a very small amount of green tea in there. And also, I believe it's decaffeinated, isn't it?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
I don't think so, but it might be. I'm going to have to actually look into that.
Okay.
But, yeah. No, June, you can take it earlier in the day. It's perfectly fine. Take your morning dose and then take another dose maybe between lunch and dinner. And if you are having GERD in the evening, pop a DGL, a deglycerizated licorice. You could take that in the evening or something. That would be fine.
I just did a quick search. You know, it's one of the nice things about us tag teaming on this is that, you know, while you go in the ring and get beat up, I can go and refresh myself in the corner. It says, how much caffeine is in green tea extract? There's an article here in livestrong.com.
Yeah.
And it says green tea extract.
The thing about green tea, where you don't feel the caffeine effects you would like a cup of coffee or even black tea, is the L-theanine. The L-theanine attenuates that.
Okay, so here it is.
Yeah.
They did a study. This is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The study found that the caffeine content of green tea extract supplements ranged from 0.6 milligrams per day, which is inconsequential. It's less than you get from a decaf, to 20. So a cup of, like a real strong Starbucks would be like 200-300 milligrams.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So 20 is not that much.
You would get that. 20 you might get in a decaf, too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Well, hold on. I think a regular cup of coffee is probably going to be, 100 to 140 if it's strong. If it's weak, maybe 80.
So also, I just don't think there's that much green tea in that product. I think there's a little bit of a nod towards green tea, but it's not like taking a green tea capsule, concentrated capsule.
Right, right. There's a little EGCG in there. There's some astaxanthin in there. There's some apple fruit powder. There's, I believe, some slippery elm in there as well. All good things, too.
I would recommend trying it.
Yeah.
You know, at the risk of having one bad night's sleep, but I just don't think that there's that much in there. And I think let's send a little missive off to our friends at Orthomolecular who make Endofen, and we can probably get a precise answer on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very
so let's
good.
Let's bookmark that and see if we can do that sometime during the week.
Okay. So June, continue taking your Endofen. It's perfectly fine.
Okay.
Especially your morning dose. Right.
Well, as the adage goes, time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, you're kidding.
So let's pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. And so give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
I have a problem with eating eggs lately.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to address that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people are intolerant to eggs.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
It's one of the top 8 food allergens. So
yeah. Okay.
We'll dive into it.
Yep. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mudin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we'll be right back with more on this Intelligent Medicine Podcast.